Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, Benny wanted to talk about pro player development. What does that pipeline look like here in the United States? And a little bit more broadly speaking, how do you get to becoming a pro? What are the odds of becoming a pro? And then what happens once you actually do become a pro? How much longevity do you have? What is the probability of having longevity? What is required of having longevity and reaching your true potential? So that's what Benny wanted to discuss. But first, we do a little bit of bullshitting, okay? But the bullshitting has a lot of gold nuggets in there. He prompts me with an audience question regarding coaching. And it's a specific question regarding coaching. So Benny, you know, tries to extract a lot of information from me there, and then we dive into the pro player development pipeline. It's a good episode, folks. You don't want to miss it. And coaches, you know the drill. You need to be going to 343coaching.com to get your premium coaching education there, or your free coaching education there. If you already have a long history with 343, reading our articles, listening to podcasts, going to the YouTube channel, seeing our teams play, et cetera, et cetera, you just dive into the premium program. Don't wait any longer. But if you're new here, well, I recommend the free program because you really need to get to know us. What have we accomplished here in the ecosystem? Why is it imperative, in my sincere opinion, that you eventually graduate to get in the premium coaching program? But start with the free one. So 343coaching.com is where you want to go. Parents, it's the same sort of story for you. You are coaches. Just not coaches necessarily on the field. You are the coaches off the field, which means you have your kids 23 hours of the day or 22 hours of the day, with the other 1 or 2 hours being with your team coach. But what do you do with those 20, 22 hours? You need to be able to mentor and guide them appropriately. For you, you go to 343masterclass.com. That is where we have codified our decades worth of experience here in the American environment at every age group, at both genders, up to and including the better part of 10 years in the professional environment. We've seen countless cycles, folks, countless cycles of kids coming in at 8, leaving at 18, going becoming college players or professional players, and then aging out at whatever the case may be, 30 years of age, 32 years of age, so on and so forth. So we've seen it all. We've codified it all. Parents, you go to 343masterclass.com to get started on that program. Last but certainly not least, if you're coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, here we go. I hope you enjoy this one regarding pro player development, but first, it's going to be an audience question. Here we go.
Before we get into the actual topic, I just received an email this morning, maybe at 7 a.m. from a longtime member. I think it's cool that this guy's emailing me for advice now. But he says, last season, I used the methodology to coach our U11 girls third team, and it was a huge success. We didn't win every game, but we were possessing the ball better than every team. Most don't even try to possess the ball. We faced some teams and beat some teams that were way bigger and more athletic than us. With the girls, I used to tell them, let's make the other team chase the ball and get tired. This season, I have the privilege of taking over our new U9 top girls team, the youngest age we have. Very excited to shape the future of the club. We usually have the top 1 to 3 girls team in the state at every age group, so the expectations are very high. With the U9 girls that have some technical foundation already from camps and other programs we run, what should my approach be with them? Should I lean more towards one thing or another, or treat them the same as the olders? Let's start right there.
Exactly the same. The U9s, they can't do a 4v1 rondo like the top teams in the world.
Yeah, I had a feeling that would be your answer, right? Everything pretty much stays the same. And a lot of people say, Gary, this guy's coaching 8-year-old girls. You know, a lot of people are going to say, oh, Gary, Benny, they're 8 years old. You know, let them play, or, you know, it should be more simple than what you're trying to achieve with the older age groups. But I think the sooner that you start with these younger teams, the more progress they're going to see.
Yeah. And we always say, look, if you're 4, 5, 6, 7, maybe 8 also, okay, let them play, let them have a good time. It's more informal, not so much methodology stuff, and let them fall in love with the ball. But if these girls are the top team and they're kind of usually in their state among the best in their state, as the guy was mentioning, then you have that foundation already. So now it's time to get to work, and you can already start getting them into Rondo activities and maybe how to build out a little bit. And you just have to be an artist and judge what, you know, judge how much free play and recreational you're going to make it all, and how much of a structure you're going to give it all. But don't give it no structure, Ben.
And I'm curious, I don't know if this guy has the 7B7 course right now, or if he's working off the original, you know, 11B11 coaching course. But Gary, all of the same principles apply. Even if you're working off the 11B11 course, right, all of the principles can be applied to the youngest age.
Yeah, well, Benny, it's not an 11 versus 11 course. It's a framework that we developed. So when you join the premium program, it is a foundational framework. And yes, some of the footage is with Brian's U11s, right? Or 12s or 13s or whatever it was. And they were in the 11 versus 11 environment, but it's not an 11 versus 11 course. Absolutely not. In fact, our earliest members, when we first launched the program in 2013, up to and including to today, folks hop on the framework there, and they might be playing 7v7 or 9v9, and they adapt the framework to their environment. So, hey, you want to learn how to build out of the back, but you're playing 7v7? No problem. Instead of a back four, you do a back three or whatever system or formation that you choose and desire. You know, you're playing 9v9? Oh, no problem. It's simply not, you know, 4-3-3. It's some other system, but all the same principles apply.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I was just thinking more of, like, for example, the attacking patterns that are shown in the course. It's with 11, or the building out of the back is the back four and the six. Obviously, with 7v7, you're not going to have a back four. You know.
Yeah, you just adjust it, Benny. And I understand that some coaches might not be very experienced at all. They might be first-year coaches, right? Or second-year coaches or third-year coaches. And, you know, over the course of the years, some of that group, when they're just starting out, they're like, man, it would be nice if I had something totally specific and spelled out for me for 7v7.
Yeah,
right. Which is why we partnered up with John to do a 7v7 specific thing for them. Right. Because if you're a first time coach, first year coach, maybe it's a little bit challenging, though, like, to adapt the framework, and they wanted a little bit more hand holding.
Yeah. What about Gary? So I'm assuming this guy's been a member for 2-3 years. So now this guy has access to phase two, phase three. Would it be a mistake for him, for the first year that he has his new team, to start jumping onto those concepts? Should he spend an entire year just on phase one stuff, even if he has access to the other? Because my mistake when I had it, Gary, is I had access to everything. And so, yeah, I would do a lot of phase one work, but I would skip on to phase five and, like, oh, here's a badass drill. I'm going to run it with this team that I've had for 5 months and can't even grasp the concept, you know?
You know the answer. It's a massive mistake. New team? The team starts from ground zero. It doesn't matter that you've done it as a coach with other teams. As a matter of fact, it's good for the coach too to start again from ground zero, because now you're doing it with a new team for, you know, the second or third time, and you're going to get better as a coach with the core foundational framework. You're going to realize things that you did in the past. You're going to dial in even more. You're going to master the activities even more by doing it again and starting from scratch. You start from scratch, Benny, every single time. It's not like I get a new crop of students in physics, right? That they're going to do electricity and magnetism. It's a new crop. And I'm like, oh, but I already taught this, and I already know about relativity and quantum and all this other stuff. I'm just going to start teaching them the higher level things. Like, that makes zero sense, dude. They have to start from ground zero.
Right. And I know this is subjective, but at what point as a coach do you realize, okay, my players are grasping this, you know, we're having spells of possession, now I can start to layer in some more complex activities? You know, because maybe some coaches make the mistake of, they have a game or two and they were successful in building out of the back, but the team probably isn't ready to start layering on those more complex ideas. So how can you tell as a coach?
I don't know, Benny. It's hard. It's hard. You have to judge whether your players are capable or not, number one. and then judge whether your team is like totally gets it and is standing on a granite foundation. Like the granite is not going to crumble if you start building a skyscraper on top of it. You know what I mean? So some people think they have granite and actually they don't. They have quicksand. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I'm going to start building a skyscraper on this quicksand. And as soon as they start, the whole thing falls to pieces. So what does that mean, right? What does the analogy mean? It's like, oh, I'm going to start teaching these advanced attacking patterns or these básicos or these passing patterns now because, you know, I've had this team for 2 years and it looks like they're building out of the back regularly and they do pass sequences. And cool, you can try that. But as soon as you start injecting that stuff, the other stuff starts melting a little bit. And guess what? On the weekend, it's going to show that things start crumbling to pieces. So maybe experiment a little bit. And if things start crumbling, okay, you're like, okay, that was a nice little experiment. We have to go back to basics.
It's really cool, especially since you've started, you know, CCing me on all these emails, just to see the amount of coaches and teams that come back and say these things that, hey, Gary, my team bossed every single game in terms of possession. You know, my team went from the bottom to the top. I mean, you've received, I don't know, thousands of emails, Gary, right?
So I don't know if it's thousands, but I would say
I'm sure it's like close.
We can do basic back of the envelope calculation. So maybe on a weekly basis, something will come in. Maybe an email or two will come in saying, hey, you know, coaching high school, just want to let you know we won the state championship, like this sort of stuff, right? And you know, you're laughing, but you know, I think I even sent you the high school one, right? But and it was recent. Oh, you thought I was talking about you. You thought I was talking about you. I'm not talking about you, man. No, seriously, it wasn't. But you know, if you get one or two a week, maybe it's 50 to 100 a year. We've done it for like 10 years. So I don't know. We're in the hundreds for sure. I've just done a very bad job, Ben. I've been bad at business, bad at marketing, because somebody who is obsessed with this and wants to make money or something, every single time you get one of these emails, you'd be blasting it on social media. You'd be putting this stuff up all over the place. And we just haven't done that.
Well, you always say, you know, you're not in it for the money. I know it is a business and you could be, you know, making millions off of this, but, you know, we care more about the success of people implementing this methodology. I don't know. To me, it's badass. This framework actually does work, even though there's so many people out there that are against it.
Yeah. No, it works. And in all contexts. So I'll get high school coaches. I'll get the U9 girls coach. I'll get the U15 Academy coach. Bro, like even pro coaches have reached out in the past that have deployed this with men. Okay. You get the whole gamut, and it could be in Lincoln, Nebraska. It could be in Wisconsin. It could be in Southern California. It could be in Oregon. It could be anywhere.
I think, especially when you guys started this 10 years ago, and I don't even know if it's the case now, but nothing else like this exists in American soccer.
Nope.
Yeah.
Oh, Gary, arrogant. I don't care, man. It just doesn't exist. But you know what? You know what it is too, Ben, is we have a monopoly on it. And what do I mean by that? We have a monopoly in the sense that you can't replicate Brian. You're learning from Brian. You're seeing Brian do the art, okay, right, in real time. And it's not scripted. And it's with the real players and the real teams and stuff. So you can't copy that. You can go out and build a course and show, oh, here's how you do a 4v1 rondo and all this stuff, but it's not Brian, Benny.
You know, a lot of people in the past would say like, oh yeah, cool, you were able to do it at the youth level, great. You know, when you get onto the professional level, it's not going to work. Well, look at Brian right now, look at his team, look at their possession stats of every game. You know, so far he's been successful in this venture.
Yeah, there's no guarantees.
Right.
There's no guarantees. And we have to be a little bit cautious, right? Because at the pro level, there are even more factors outside of the control of the coach that influence results ultimately. Like at the youth level, you have a lot of control as a coach. At the pro level, not so much. And folks who especially follow American soccer and MLS in particular, the national team and stuff, like I regularly throw out this story. So Steve Cherundolo, I'm assuming everybody knows who Steve Cherundolo is, the coach of LAFC. Well, he started like in Germany. I think it was Stuttgart, as an assistant. And team didn't do great or whatever. Granted, he wasn't the head coach or whatever, but he moved to the States. And when we moved to the States, he got his start here in coaching with Las Vegas Lights, USL team. I think the team ended up being the worst in the league, like dead last or second to last. It was just shocking and appalling. And I saw a whole bunch of their games. Bad, really bad. And then LAFC hires him, and you would think to yourself, right? Wait, if this is a performance merit-based profession, why did they go out and hire the worst performing coach in all of USL for an MLS team? Nevertheless, you know, that's another rabbit hole, but nevertheless, put that aside, he comes and takes over LAFC, and he wins MLS Cup. I think it was the first year he got into the job, he wins MLS Cup. So is Steve Cherundolo a terrible coach? Because if you're looking at the box score and the stats initially, you're like, terrible, the worst, and at a lower level than MLS. And then he gets his MLS gig, and he wins the whole thing. So is he a phenomenal, amazing Pep Guardiola coach? Like, which one is it? You know, if you're just looking at the stats, how do you know? How do you know? And now LAFC is not doing great. And so LAFC fan base and everybody's kind of like, get rid of this guy. He's terrible. But just a few short years ago, he was the best, right? And he was being considered for the U.S. men's national team and all that stuff. So it's very difficult, Benny, in my opinion, at the pro level to discern, because we had just had an episode, right, that we released on discerning what's a good quality coach. Yeah. And that's very helpful in identifying it. And at the pro level, I think those things from the last episode still apply. But in the back of your head, you still have to kind of inject a little bit of uncertainty because you don't know the outside factors, Ben. For example, maybe the sporting director, the board of the club is like, you know what? We're going to sell this player, and this player. And they destroy your team at that point. And they're going to sell them, and they're not going to replenish, you know? Or if they replenish, they don't replenish with the player profile that you want, you know? And you as a coach, you only have a certain amount of power. So what's going to happen next season is that same coach, I don't care if it's Pep Guardiola himself, you're kind of in trouble at that point. So I don't know why we got off on that tangent, but you were talking about Brian and his current success. Yeah, man, I think people should watch the team play. I mean, he keeps outpossessing. The last game, he outpossessed again, right?
Yeah. Okay. It's really kind of sad how people only sometimes look at results. I mean, for example, you just brought up Pep, right? In the last season, they went on like, I don't know, a 10-game losing streak or whatever. And then you see all these people in the media start smearing him like, oh, see, Pep doesn't know what he's doing. Like, what are you talking about, bro?
Yeah. This guy's been waiting.
Yeah, they just wait for, I mean, dude, you can only be at the top for so long, bro, you know, but even still, like in those games that they were losing, they're still bossing the game, still dominating possession. It just, sometimes in football, it doesn't go your way, but it's just funny how people rely on results to then say like, oh, see, I told you, Dunning-Kruger effect, bro, that you always bring up. That.
Yeah, there's that. And the, you know, it's a spectator sport, right? So, you know, I always think about the Roman Colosseum and, you know, the gladiators in the arena sort of thing. I think that's a quote from Teddy Roosevelt, right? And the critics are all in the stands and whatever. You have to talk about stuff. And what's more obvious than this gladiator killed that gladiator, so this one is better than that one. You know?
Yeah.
So it's the same principle applies. This team won 2-1, so this team is better than that team. And I think we all kind of understand, even the critics, that that's not always the case, and you have to look a little bit deeper. And hopefully, if we're doing our job right, you and I, Benny, with these episodes and articles and everything that we put out in public, if we're doing our job right, we're trying to help unpeel more of those layers for people to say, okay, hold on. Yeah, they lost 2-1, but let's go to layer 2 to see what's happening. And then layer 3, and then layer 4, and then layer 100, right? But I think that mostly is applicable to practitioners, right? The people in the Roman Colosseum just want to see the blood. They don't care.
Gladiator 2, bro. Sick movie.
Oh, that was a shockingly bad movie. I actually watched that movie, Ben.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, so bad. So bad.
Yeah. Well, you can never beat the original. So it's always hard when you have a sequel, bro. But...
True. True. Yeah. Okay. So what's the episode about, Benny?
Well, one last thing I wanted to say, I think it would be, and some people already do this, but I think it'd be really cool along with these testimonial emails that people send you. Like if they can post on their social medias and say, you know, look at our team implementing 343 methodology. Cause I think the more people that see it and are aware of it, I think it just helps to grow the audience and helps for people to start opening their eyes, to start peeling back the onion and say, hey, like, this is actually possible, you know? And it doesn't have to be a top MLS Next team or ECNL team. If you have a, like this guy, dude, he said his U11s were bossing games. Yeah, like, post it, bro. Let's all support each other and build each other up, dude.
Yeah. I thought for a little while, but there's so many projects I would like to do, and I say no to so many because I don't have time. I thought about creating maybe like a LinkedIn, but just for soccer coaches. It's a soccer coach specific site where coaches like put up their resumes and put up the videos, you know, they upload a video library of their teams actually playing. Maybe they also upload them training the team itself. And I know you can do this sort of stuff with Huddle and things of that nature as well, but this is very specific to soccer coaches only, and it's like a resume builder for soccer coaches, period. Yeah. And if you're a parent or something like that, you're like, oh, I want to find a coach, you know, in this area and this, like who does things right and all that stuff. Maybe they do a little search if they're in Phoenix, Arizona, and here's the list of all the coaches in Phoenix, Arizona. And you click on every one of their resumes and you see all their videos and you see their training sessions and off you go. You're off to the races. I know it's kind of impractical too, because you're geographically limited, Ben. Like if you live in Phoenix, okay, you have to look within a 20-mile radius or something, right? You're not going to go 75 miles to play for a team.
Yeah, for sure. Or it's like, rate my professor, bro. Rate my coach.
Bro, you know how bad that would be? Disgruntled parents will go and say, this guy's an asshole. Like,
yeah. I don't know if you know this, bro, but I would say, and I'm making this up, bro, but 90%, 85% of students, like they will not enroll into a class until they've gone on Rate My Professor and seen all the reviews, seen is this teacher strict or not. You know, sometimes when I need a little entertainment, I go on Rate My Professor and look at Gary Clapin, bro.
Is it bad? Is it bad? How is it, man?
Well, there's some good reviews on there. But again, I haven't been on in a while, bro. But you always have, every teacher has like that disgruntled student that didn't pass the class and, you know, oh, this guy's shocking.
Yeah.
I think some of the comments are like, oh, and he just lectures like freely. He doesn't pass out notes or anything.
For sure. Well, I think we talked about that in one of a previous episode, that when you know your shit extremely well, you don't need a PowerPoint and you're reading off of a PowerPoint, but that's the most boring thing ever. Or you don't need like physical lecture notes and you're looking at your notes and then just replicating it like live in front of, like, what is that? That demonstrates you don't know what the hell you're doing. So yeah, I go in there, no notes, no nothing. Okay, what's the topic today? Oh, we're doing, I don't know, RC circuits. Great, here we go. Let's talk about RC circuits. This is what a resistor is. This is what a capacitor is. You put them both together. This is how the circuit behaves. Oh, why does it behave this way? Because this is what's happening with the electrons and this is what's happening with the potential differences and you're off to the races. Anybody have questions? Oh, you have a question? Cool. Give it to me. Any question at all, go for it. And I don't have to pause and open up a book or see if figure things out. No. Bam, bam, bam.
Yeah, but then they don't ask you questions, bro. Like, dude, this generation of students is, I don't think they realize that you actually have to read like outside of class to grasp the cut. Like, sure, you can be in your lecture and you're going to get it to a certain extent, right? But if you're not spending time outside of the class studying and reading, then you're screwed. Well, I remember we were at Olipit one time and you had like a Zoom meeting with one of your students and this guy's like, oh, Gary, I'm failing. Like, I don't know what to do. And you're like, right, let me ask you this. How many times have you opened your textbook this semester? He's like, I don't have the book yet.
Bro. midway through the semester, doesn't have the book. And no, and it wasn't, and I understand, right? Some people are financially strapped and stuff like that. And it's, maybe it's like an $80 textbook or something like that. But that's not the case. That's not the case.
And so it was in like a nice ass room, gaming chair. Like this still has money.
No, and what's wild, Ben, in this new world of AI, I'm not sure too many appreciate, and I'm still trying to understand what's going on too, but I'm not sure too many appreciate that to actually use the AIs and leverage them and get ahead and learn, you have to know how to prompt them. You have to know the language associated with a particular subject. Otherwise, you have no idea how to talk to it. No clue. You'll always be superficial and you won't be able to go down the rabbit hole.
Prompt engineering, bro.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. Actually, you know what I should start doing? I've been meaning to do this. Is start prompting it on out of curiosity because I really don't care about soccer, right? I should start asking it things about... I should ask about things about soccer. Oh, hey, you know, if you're going up against a team that, you know, you're usually 4-3-3 and they're 4-4-2, you know, what are the advantages, disadvantages? What should I do if I'm losing 2-1, you know, and they're playing a low block? You know, what kind of strategies, tactics should I deploy? You know, oh, that's interesting. You should cross it to the weak side or whatever. Okay, how would I train that in training sessions? Like you could have this whole conversation and knowing a significant amount about a particular domain, you'd be able to judge whether its answers are pretty good or pretty decent. And I think maybe a lot of coaches should start using it, honestly. Yeah. The problem is, Ben, that it only knows the current LLMs. They only know what they've been fed. And most of what they've been fed is all mainstream stuff, right? And unfortunately, most mainstream stuff is just bang on average stuff. That's why it's mainstream. You know what I mean? And so the probability of its answers are going to lean towards the bang on average sort of things.
The AI is going to come back and you can say, hey, how do I break down this low block? It's going to like, hit it long, launch it.
I'm telling you, man. So I don't know. That's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah. All right, dude. Let's 26 minutes into it. Let's get into it, bro. You know, somebody commented like, oh, the actual title of the discussion, it happens at, you know, whatever, 25 minutes, but there's a lot of good stuff before, dude. So,
and there is.
I think it would be cool to start every episode with a member question. You know, somebody that's in the program has questions, shoot an email to you or myself, and because I think that gets the juices flowing for us as well. Yeah.
Possibly. Yeah, possibly. It loosens everything up. But maybe our title should be something like 20 minutes of shit talking and then what makes for a good coach.
For sure, dude.
Let's try it. For this episode, let's go 20 minutes of shit talking and then whatever it is that you're going to propose to me now.
All right. I like it. I want to talk today, Gary, about what does it take to actually become a pro? And I know it back in, I think it was April, we recorded on the pathway to pro, meaning like, okay, what league should I join? Should I attempt to go to college? Should I attempt the pathway to USL? But what does it actually take as a player, like from the youth to becoming a pro, right? And I want to first start by referencing an article that you wrote in 2020, where it's titled Quality Pro Player Development or Recreation. People don't know the difference. And just in that first opening line, you say a line must be drawn between two camps. Those who ultimately view soccer as recreation and those who are about creating professional footballers of the highest quality, right? So again, we've mentioned this before. Obviously, everybody's not trying to become pro, but there are a vast majority of people out there that is their goal. And if you're a coach, that is your goal. You're serious about it. You are doing everything possible in your sessions off the field to help your players become a pro. I guess my first question for you, Gary, you guys have had a lot of pros that have come through your ranks, but what did those players have at an early age that separated them from the other players? Is it you have to be kind of born with special traits and qualities, and then that's how you get elevated from your coaches, or can those special qualities be learned from a young age?
first things first, you need to have some sort of athleticism and you have to have some sort of technique. I think those two things are the most foundational thing. So you can't be a completely unathletic person. And I know that over the years, since we started writing stuff in 2009 with the 343 blog, I always kind of was anti big, fast, strong, because everybody here in the States was so pro big, fast, strong, because that's how you win games at the youth level. And then it carried over into college, and then it carried over into the pro ranks here with the national team and Major League Soccer, is all the coaches, everybody was, who's the biggest, who's the fastest, who's the strongest sort of thing. And the reason I kind of like railed against that is because that metric was so overvalued. It is important, Benny. People would get this wrong. It is important. You have to be athletic. But the base level to which you have, the threshold level, is much lower than what the culture here has always been, right? So can you be a Busquets sort of body type? Yes, you can. But then the technical level and the IQ level and the mentality level has to be through the roof to compensate for you being a Busquets body type instead of, you know, a beast sort of body type. So it all kind of balances out in the end. So first things first, at least somewhat athletic, right? You can't be the slowest guy in your middle school, right? Or something like that. Number two is obviously technique. So the earlier you start messing around with the ball, the better. If you start, you know, if the kid starts walking and you already give them a little tiny little soccer ball and, you know, have them kick it around or step on top of the ball and develop some affinity with the ball, you're off to the races at that point. So by the time they're 7, 8, 9, if you are among, you should be among the best in your team, honestly, in whatever team you join, whether it be a rec team or a club team or travel team, when you're 7, 8, 9, you should be amongst the better players and have a little bit of athleticism. So that gets you off to the races. Is it necessary? No, but you're already behind the curve. So with our teams, because you mentioned our teams and we graduated a lot of professional players over the years, the famous team that's on YouTube, right, was U11. So there were a bunch of 10-year-olds running around, and you can see that they are have athleticism, some level. They're not the biggest, they're not the fastest, they're not the strongest, but not by a long shot. We were outmatched in the big, fast, strong category, Benny. That team was, okay? But they were athletic, but they had massive technique, Ben. We didn't give them that technique. When we got the U10 or U11 team, the technique that they had was something that was workable. We had good material, Ben. So you have to have good material. And then, I mean, this is a whole pipeline, but there's a whole process, Benny. I don't know where you want me to go with that.
Yeah. Well, really quick, let me stop you right there. Two things. One, you say that these players came into the team already with technique. You know, was that because, like you said, they were touching the ball since they were a kid? They were always playing pickup. They were playing futsal before they actually got to the team environment. Because I think a lot of,
for sure,
a lot of parents or maybe even coaches think that all of this technique stuff should be taught within the team training environment. But I think by the time that all of these players got to your guys' team, I mean, they already had massive level of technique. I know that we've brought this up in the podcast before, but I remember when Brian first saw Efrain Alvarez, he was, you know, scouting a game, and then he sees this little kid at halftime, one of the brothers of the team, I don't know how old he was, 7 or 8 years old, and hitting like 30-yard rockets, bro. Like, incredible technique at that young age. So how did those players get it, you know?
No, Ben, outside the team environment, playing with your brothers, playing with your dad, playing with your cousins, playing in a park, kicking the ball against the wall, breaking stuff in the household because you don't stop kicking the ball and stuff. Like, that's how they got it. Yeah. That's how they got it. And let's be very careful. Are these players already made and they don't need to work on their technique? Of course not. We're just saying that they have at least a base level of technical ability that then now you as a coach can start working and polishing and improving on. And you don't have to start from ground zero. If you get a bunch of players that are 10 years old and they've never kicked a ball in their life, then you're starting from ground zero. That's a big problem. The chances of graduating a professional from there is very difficult at that point.
Right.
To be clear, the coaches have a massive influence on technique too, but you have to have some raw material to work from. You can't make a beautiful sculpture out of, you know, if there's nothing there, if there's no marble to work with.
It reminds me, Gary, of a tweet that Paul Spacey posted maybe like a month ago, where there's this former NFL player, Christian Okoye, I think that's his name. And he moved to the U.S. from Nigeria when he was 21 years old. And this guy had never played professional football, never even touched a football. And then 5 years later, all of a sudden, he's an NFL pro. And Paul's point is, this could never happen in soccer, ever, right? If you haven't touched the ball, even by the time you're 13 or 14, like, you're never going pro, bro. You know, it's completely, completely different.
I tend to agree, because I think there's something with the fact that if you want to manipulate something with your hands versus wanting to manipulate something with your feet, it's easier for a human to do the former and not the latter, right? It's easy for you to kind of figure out hand-related things versus foot-related things. So, right. Yeah, if you haven't tried to manipulate anything, a ball in this case, by the time you're 13, you're going to have a really hard time adapting and getting your brain to work with your feet to manipulate the ball versus somebody who's been doing it since they were 3 years old.
Right. And dude, I'm sure people have seen videos of professional athletes that aren't soccer players, and you see them attempt to kick a ball or like shoot it, and it's absolutely shocking, bro.
It's the worst thing ever. Or stop a ball or anything. Yeah. It's all wrong. But look, if you look at a soccer player, Christian Pulisic, if you see him shooting a basketball, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't look awkward or weird, or, you know, it doesn't look wrong. It doesn't, you know what I'm saying?
So, okay, here, back to the topic. How much, obviously these guys, they came into the team environment, were training 2-3 times a week at a young age with Brian. How much work were they putting in outside of the team environment at those ages when they were at the Chivas Academy and later on to the Galaxy?
How much were they doing outside?
Yeah. I mean, do you know? Like, were they on the wall every day?
I can't possibly know that.
If you had to guess, or any player that's trying to become pro and they're in that type of environment, is it a daily thing where, because we brought this up before, you look at Efra, right? Obviously, extremely technical player. I can't imagine that he was training outside of the team environment every single day on the wall, putting in extra work. He kind of just had that sauce, and you know what I mean?
I do. And they did play outside the team environment. They were always kicking a ball. If you're talking about Efra had older brothers who were soccer players, and one of them was a pro and stuff. He was messing around with the ball one way or another. I'm sure when he got home or before going to training or during school or something, he's messing with the ball, juggling or heading it or dribbling around the house 100 million%, or playing some pickup games here, there, or going to the tennis courts and playing tennis volleyball with whoever. 100% they were doing that. It's just being able to quantify it is hard to know. But if I had to guess, I don't think a single player went a whole day without actually touching a ball. I'm pretty sure that's probably a true statement.
Yeah. So, okay, if that's the case, Gary, is it fair to say that players that are only touching the ball within their team training environment, they're never going to make it far in this game? Is that a fair assessment?
I think it's fair. I think there are exceptions, because, you know, one right off the top of my head is like nepotism stuff, right? There are things that happen outside of a pure meritocracy that can make you be a pro. But I think it's a fair statement for you to say. Yeah.
So let's look a little bit on the mentality side at the younger ages, and then we'll move on to once you become a pro, you're like, what does it take? But the mentality of a young player has a pretty clear path to the pro level as a kid, right, Gary? It's obviously hard because there's so many influences outside. You want to hang out with your friends. You want to, you know, go to the movies, hang out with your girl. What type of mentality is required at those young ages?
Yeah, by young ages, you mean what?
Let's say like 13, 14, 15.
I think you have to start taking things more seriously from a discipline perspective and start looking at it more as a responsibility versus just a game. I think that's one thing. So such things as being on time and you know, not dicking around in training sessions as much, taking every repetition seriously. I like, these are the sorts of things that a young player, an adolescent, can put on their shoulders and will help them develop the mentality side of things. The problem that I've come to appreciate even more over the last handful of years is that if you already have professional player potential in you, where you're good enough, or potentially good enough, if that's the case, then you're probably one of the stars of your team or one of the stars of the region or the state or whatever. And so you don't face adversity with being benched. You know what I'm saying? You don't face adversity with not being good enough. And so it's smooth sailing for you a lot of the time. You can really mess up on the discipline, on the commitment side of the equation, on the effing around during training, on all of the, you can mess around. You can mess up on all that stuff and you're still starting games on the weekends and you're still scoring goals or you're still, you know, getting called up to youth national teams and that sort of stuff. So that's a big challenge. That's a very big challenge. And I think that might be one of the edges that foreign countries also have on us, because since that the cultures outside of here who have professional academies take it so seriously because it's more of a business in that sense, where they need players to graduate to the first team and be successful, I think they have techniques to make sure that doesn't happen to the young players, right? Like they will straight bench you or something, or they will graduate you to playing 2 years up and you're going to be on the bench when you're playing 2 years up. You're not going to be the automatic starter or the star anymore. And overseas, you can do that because where is that particular player, academy player going to go? You can't just say, you know what? I don't like you, coach. I don't like you, Ajax. I'm going to leave and go to Feyenoord, or I'm going to leave and go to Rotterdam or PSV, or you know what I'm saying? Like it's not that easy for you to just pack your bags and go to another club or go to another coach. But here it's really easy.
Yeah. And I think overseas, they have that luxury to be able to bench those players and kind of teach them a lesson, because you look at a roster over there, let's say La Masia, instead of one or two efforts on the team, there's 15 of them, bro. And so at the young ages, those kids are used to adversity. Like if I'm not showing up on time, if I'm not working my ass off in training, if I don't have the right mentality, look at how easy it is for me to become the bench or, you know, coming in late in the game. Whereas over here, maybe you only have, as a coach, one or two special players. And yeah, obviously every coach over here wants to win. So if your star guy shows up 5 minutes late to training or didn't have the best training session, are you going to bench him in the next game? Probably not, bro. Probably not. And I think you mentioned it, Gary. A massive problem in this country is parents and players are so quick to leave when things get tough. Like, oh, my team came in fifth place, now I want to go be on the top team. Or, oh, my son wasn't getting enough playing time, fuck this coach, I'm bouncing. You know, it's just they're bouncing one place after another. It's like they can't stick out through any adversity, dude. And so even the players that do make it out of the system and go pro, they're not used to facing any adversity. So 10 games on the bench and they fold, bro. Massive problem in this country.
Yeah. Yeah. No question, man. And it's all due to lack of competition.
Emotional relegation. It always comes up.
Yeah. No, 100% is just lack of competition. That's what it is. And here the mainstream is still trying to push for things to be less competitive than they already are. They want less competition. Oh, don't keep scores in games. Oh, don't show the table of the standings, you know, online. Oh, you know, you could be the worst MLS Next team or ECNL team. You're not going to get relegated to a lower league or nothing. No, there's no competition, Ben. And then you get to the pro level, there's no competition. MLS, you know, we're going to suspend Messi and Jordi Alba because they didn't show up to the All-Star game. So they're not going to get to play in a league match, right? And a league match is supposed to be the competition, right? So the competition like doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter if Inter Miami lost that game because Messi wasn't allowed to play. It doesn't matter at all because whatever, 9 out of the 12 teams in the conference make the playoffs. So the probability you're not going to, like, it's so stupid, Benny.
Yeah. I was driving by a field the other day, Gary, and I saw like a poster for an AYSO tournament. And at the bottom of the poster, it says trophies and medals for first place through sixth place.
And that's cool. But look, it's cool. You started the episode with an article that I wrote, right? What was it again? Quality pro player development versus recreational. That we have to know the difference. Hey, if you're a rec program like AYSO and they market themselves as a recreational program, great. Do trophies for everybody, medals for everybody. Don't keep score. Do whatever. No problem. Orange slices at halftime for everybody. Capri Suns, you know, all good. All good. But if you're going to market yourself as a competitive league or a competitive club or a competitive team or a competitive coach, and okay, it's time to turn off the recreational switch, ladies and gents.
Yeah. And when people hear recreation, Gary, I think they automatically assume it's AYSO or rec soccer, but it can even be a club flight two team, even a flight one team where the coach is just chilling, bro. No state of mind or no desire to actually help improve his players. They win because they have one man child. Like that's recreational too, bro.
Here's the dirty little secret of American soccer nobody wants to talk about. It's all recreation. All of it. Oh, my son's on an MLS Next team or something. You're on a rec team. You're in a rec league. You're in a rec team. Oh, we got accepted to ECNL. Great. I understand that's a good business thing, right? For the club, for the teams, for the players to be spotted by college coaches. Great. All that's true. All that's great. It's a rec league with rec clubs and rec teams. All of it. Oh, my team won the national championship or the state. You're a rec team. It's not serious. Because all the things that we just finished discussing, like, hey, if you have the best player, like, are they being benched? Are you being serious about developing pros? Nah, they're not serious about developing pros. None of these teams are serious. What do you get for developing a pro? You don't get shit.
You get a post on Instagram, dude. What other choices do the parents have? Because you just named off, quote unquote, the top leagues in the U.S., ECNL, MLS Next. What other choice do parents have that's not recreational?
Yeah, you have to get lucky. You have to get lucky and having landed at a team. I would say there's zero clubs that are serious. Zero. Zero. No exceptions. You want to say, oh, the LA Galaxy or FC Dallas, fucking wreck. The whole MLS itself, it's wreck. They literally say it's about entertainment. Oh, Gary, it's just a game. It's just for entertainment. Okay, it's wreck then. The whole thing's fucking wreck. So you just have to get lucky to land at a team with a particular coach and staff that takes the craft very seriously and makes it known up front that, hey, we're here to develop pro players. You're asking me about pro player development, right? So that's what it has to be.
How much of it, Gary, is the actual coach that is basically making the player become pro? Because I always think of an example of, let's say Brian had a completely different crop of players and he got them at 8 or 9 years old. No efforts, though, like a completely different team. Like, I think those players right now would be elevated and potentially in pro teams because of the coaching that they receive, because of the culture that they experience, right? Like, not to say that all those players that went pro got lucky to find, oh, this team environment with Brian, but obviously you and Brian were a massive part of their success in graduating to the pro level. So how much of it is the coach?
Yeah, it's hard to come up with something that's falsifiable. Yeah. And because you can't see the two universes or three universes if Brian had the FC Golden State team, how many of the Golden State players would have been pros and how many of the Barcelona USA, TFA, Chivas, and Galaxy did not become pros? Or if Brian had the Pats team, which I mentioned Golden State and Pats because those were two of the biggest rivals kind of our squad, and they had exceptional talent on their team. But what I can say is I know who those players were at FC Golden State and Pats, and I think there's zero made pro. I think maybe one made a pro team in USL or something, and nobody else, zero And Brian graduated like nine players, you know, out of that one squad, or seven players out of that one squad to being pros. So there's always that sort of comparison. You just have to get lucky, Benny, honestly. And, you know, I'm working on a pretty extensive article or paper, I don't know what you want to call it, where I take the Drake equation and I use that kind of in the soccer context to answer the question of what is the probability of a particular player in the United States becoming a pro. Now, somebody can just do a simple calculation, say how many soccer players are there, period, how many make it pro, and do the percentage. No, but this one is more in depth, where an actual individual can kind of judge their probability of making it versus some broad-based thing. So the Drake equation is the equation from Frank Drake, physicist back in the day, who wanted to estimate the probability of an intelligent spacefaring civilization existing, like in the galaxy, right? So you take all these factors. So like one of the factors is, okay, so what is the average rate of star formation in the galaxy? Okay, so you need to know that. You also have to know what is of those stars, what fraction of them have planets? And then of that, those planets, what fraction of them are kind of in the Goldilocks zone, right? Just not too close to the star, not too far away from the star. And of those planets, you know, how many of them had life, you know, arise on them? And of those, how many of that life became intelligent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So it's, I don't remember how many factors. I think maybe it's, if I remember correctly, maybe it's like seven total factors that it has. And so we can apply the same sort of thing here. It's like, what is the probability that you are born like in a city in the United States that has a vibrant soccer community? Because that's very impactful. You know what I mean? If you're born in the middle of nowhere where it's all farmland and nobody's playing soccer in your region at all, what's the probability that kid's going to become a professional soccer player? So that's one thing, the geographic question. Then the other question is, hey, what is the probability that your parents played, right? That or were pros or something like that, right? Because that ends up being a very important factor as well. And then what is the probability that you land on a highly competitive team or something like that? And then what is the probability that you're in MLS next? Because if you're not in MLS next or not in the top leagues or something, you're kind of invisible. And then what is the probability of you being called to a youth national team? And then what is the probability that, you know, so you can come up with all these different factors, multiply them all out, and then you get yourself a nice little probability of you becoming a professional soccer player.
The Kleiman equation, bro.
I did a terrible job explaining it because I've never, you know, I haven't looked at it in a while. I want to revisit it, and I've never articulated it verbally. Did it kind of make some sense?
It did. Yeah, it did. I mean, I think it would be incredibly valuable for not only parents, but coaches as well, to have those types of percentages. But yeah, dude, once that equation is done, dude, let me know. Everybody wants to see it. Okay, so Gary, a player defies all the odds. He makes a pro, he made it to USL, or he's made it to MLS. We talked about this the last time we met up when we were at Chop House, right? You see it today, especially with the younger generation. Player finally has money that he's never had. He finally has access to all these different luxuries. You know, what does it actually take to maintain a professional standard, maintain being a pro soccer player? Because I think once, and again, I'm referring to this new generation of players coming up, once they make it onto a pro team, it seems to be the case where they think they've made it and they think that they don't have to put in any more work, and they can kind of take their foot off the pedal a little bit. I mean, you see all these, and again, we're not going to name any names, but you see their priorities, even on their social media accounts, where it's when they were a kid, it was them posting footage from them in the game or extra training. And now as a pro, what do you see them posting? Freaking, hey, I just went to Louis Vuitton. Look at the shit that I bought. Or, hey, look at, I'm at this fancy dinner now. And you see the downfall of those players so rapidly. So once you get to that stage of, hey, I'm a young player, I'm 17, 18, 19, I'm a pro now. How do you maintain that? Because it's easier said than done, right? I mean, it's hard, bro. And you spent your whole life as a soccer player. You've never had any other job. I mean, soccer is your life. And so once you get to that stage, it's now this is a full-time job. It's not a recreation team, as you like to say.
Yeah. Well, I'll say from my experience, right, and not being a pro player, right, but being in that world for close to 10 years now, from that and from testimonials of former players, right, if you want to listen to me, it's harder to stay than it is to get there. I mean, it's really hard to get there, really hard. I just went through this whole Drake equation thing, like, and when you think about it, you're like, God damn, it's really hard. The probability is like almost zero that I'm going to become a pro. And now it's not just me. Former pros are saying it's harder to stay a pro, right? And have permanence and longevity than to actually get there. So what does that mean? And I think when we last met, I told you that I came across this reel. I want to find it, of Oscar Ruggeri. Ruggeri was a former Argentine player, national team player, longtime career, played at Real Madrid, played at all the big teams, Boca, River, you name it, in Europe, long trajectory, won the World Cup in 1986 with Argentina, starting center back. And he was on a show and he's like, the most important factor that he considers for his success is kind of like being paranoid every single day since he became a pro that somebody's going to eat his lunch and displace him. And so he admitted, he's like, see, the problem is I wasn't like Diego, like Maradona, right? Or like something special, or Caniggia, something special. Okay. He was just a decent center back, good center back, but nothing more than that. And he's like, I would spend way more time before training, after training, with everything involved to make sure that in every single training session and in every single match that I played, I was operating at 100%. 100%. I was paranoid that if I was 95% in any training session or in any match, that the wave of young players, right, that are nipping at my heels would overtake me. That they might get a chance, that the manager one day might substitute me out or maybe not start me a game or something, or give somebody else a chance in one of those instances. And that other kid that gets a chance is going to get even more chances. And eventually they're the starter and I'm not the starter anymore, you know, and then I'm done because I'm not special. So it was complete paranoia in his side. I think that illustrates my general opinion of your question, Ben. You have to have that sort of mentality to be the best that you can be always and forever. And every action that you take off the field, you have to have that in the back of your head. Should I drink this Coca-Cola? Coca-Cola has a lot of sugar in it. You know what I mean? Is this good for me or not? And you can't say to yourself, it's just one Coke. Like, what's it going to really do? And it probably won't do anything, but that's not the point. You'll drink the Coke or you'll have the beer, or the two beers, and then you'll go to training tomorrow and you'll be at 100% tomorrow. It's fine. But that's not the point. The point is that you start deceiving your mind and, oh, look, nothing happened. I'm still the starter. I had a beer or two. It's okay. Or I went to sleep at 2 a.m, right? And it was okay. Nothing bad happened to me in my career. But so that little virus gets in your head. And the next thing you know, you do it again, right? And then you do it again. And, you know, soon enough, you're doing it almost every day. And then guess what? One of those moments that Ruggeri was paranoid about is going to happen to you. You're not started a certain game, you know, or you're substituted out. Somebody else comes in, does a good job, takes your job, you're effed.
Yeah. And Gary, this is the problem with MLS, because this type of behavior is kind of, you know, somewhat acceptable, because your team becomes in last place, Gary. Okay, you're still in the league next year. It's not like, obviously, if you're fucking off and not performing, then maybe, okay, you get released from the club. But, you know, majority of the time, players can get away with kind of being in cruise control. Whereas if you're anywhere else in the world, it's a daily competition and you're fighting for your survival every single day, because there's always somebody behind you trying to catch up to you. You know, and
two more things, Ben, two more things. Sorry. So I painted the picture of you're already the starter. Yeah. And what you have to do to stay the starter, yeah, have a long-term career. What if you get to the level, you become a pro, congratulations, very hard, all those sorts of things, and you aren't playing from the get-go, right? Or rarely play or rarely get your opportunity. Well, the same thing applies, but even more so, because you have to catch up to the other guy. So you have to do even more than what you're currently doing. You have to go way above and beyond, Ben. And that's still no guarantee, but at least you're kind of increasing your probability that when you do get your opportunity, because maybe that other fucker fucked up a little bit, you got subbed out and you're being subbed in or something like that, that when you get your opportunity, you are operating at 100% of what you can be. Because I've seen so many players, Ben, so many players over so many years that they'll get their opportunity and they haven't been doing what they need to be doing. They get their opportunity. You're not operating at 100%. You're at 70% or 80% or 90% or 50%, heaven forbid. You get your opportunity, you go into the game and you're trash. Okay, good luck getting another opportunity, or who knows when you'll get another opportunity. Then you're done. You're done, Ben. You're done. You aren't going anywhere. And then a third component is humility, right? Being humble. Don't think that you are the shit. Congratulations, you made it. It's very difficult. You're a professional athlete, professional player. Great. You're probably high at this point. You got to be humble, man. You got to be humble. You can't think that you're bigger than you are. Oh, no, I don't want to play for this club. I'm too good for this club. Excuse me? You're too good for this club? What are you talking about?
Yep.
Oh, I don't want to go there, or I want to leave here. This is just not correct. What are you talking about, man? You think you're Messi? You're like, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go not there, not there. Yes, over there.
Oh, dude, even this is why the best in the world are the best, because I think you were the one who told me this example of Messi's first day at Inter Miami. And this guy showed up at 7 a.m. when the team is training at 10. This guy's the first one there. And it's Messi. He's achieved everything. Like, I'm sure they would have no problem with him showing up at 10, but he's still humble enough to say, like, no, I want to be the best at what I'm doing. I'm going to show up 3 hours early before everybody, you know? And imagine the players that are trying to get on the roster or trying to get off the bench. Bro, those are the guys that should be showing up at 6 a.m., 7 a.m., putting in extra work. But the best in the world, there he is, 7 a.m., where are you?
And he still doesn't have bed, to bro. Be. He doesn't have to be at all. Exactly. He could be a lazy bum and tell the owner to go fuck himself. He could do whatever he wants and he's still going to play and stuff. But no, that's not the way. And interesting, you bring up Inter Miami. They just played, you know, this League's Cup thing against some Mexican team. I forget who they played. Atlas. If you look at the roster, now they got Rodrigo de Paul, right? So another midfielder, Argentine national team and all that stuff. You look at the roster, all foreigners. If you're an American player in the Inter Miami Academy, like, I don't know what you're doing there, because good luck, you know, getting on the squad. Or why would you want to go to an academy, you know, or that academy in particular, any academy? If you look at the roster, you're like, you aren't playing. You could do all the things that we just discussed and be a super amazing, super crack feet. You aren't getting on the field. What kind of a future do you have as an Inter Miami Academy player right now? I don't know. Good luck to you.
Yeah, it's true. They're stacked right now, bro. It's crazy.
Well, these are all other considerations, because you're asking me about making it, getting to be a pro, or making it once you're a pro and stuff. These are all sort of external factors also that you have to be aware of, because it's not just Inter Miami. You can look at like the LA Galaxy or LAFC or whoever it is, and you just pay attention and or the league as a whole. Pay attention. How many foreigners they bring in? What position are those foreigners usually in? Okay, they're usually like the creative types or attackers and goals, that sort of stuff. So if you're like a creative type, like creative midfielder or a winger or a striker or something, like you're in trouble. You're in trouble. They'll just go get a Uruguayan or an Argentinian or a Brazilian or a French or whatever, and like you're. Like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Like, hoping and praying. Oh, I hope my kid gets accepted to the Philadelphia Union, you know, blah, blah, because look at Jack McGlynn. He made it there or whatever. Like, the one fucking exception out of a million And you're like, oh, like, come on, man.
People are hoping or praying that they're going to be that one exception, dude.
Yeah. So it's tough. It's a tough business, Benny. It's a very tough business.
Let me ask you this last question, Gray. If a player has the luxury, let's say at 17, 18, 19, they have the resources, they have the quality, they have the talent, how soon, you know, should they make the move out of the U.S. to go to any other country if they can? If, because again, obviously it's extremely difficult out there, but even if it's a third division or fourth division team, is that more beneficial than staying and playing in USL? Or? Is it a case-by-case basis?
Case-by-case. Everything's case-by-case, Benny. How good are you really? You know, it is the number one consideration. How good are you really? And then the other consideration is the mentality thing. It's not easy. It's not easy being away from home and that sort of stuff. Luckily, and I've said this publicly many a times as I was involved in it too, is USL is a good pathway now for that type of player. You're 16 years old, you're 17, you're 18. And let's say that you're one of those positions that I just said, you're kind of screwed in MLS, right? Get your ass, become a pro in the USL environment. There's not as stiff a competition. They're not going to import a $15 million European player or South American player in your position. They're not going to do that in USL. So get your ass over there, get a lot of playing time. Luckily, the broadcasts have gotten quite good in USL, are getting better and better, and you're going to get good footage of your playing. And luckily, there is a pathway from USL overseas. There is a pathway. You just need to have good representation that believes in you, number one. And then you obviously have to perform. So that pathway exists, Ben. And if you want to go to MLS after USL, that pathway exists too.
Yeah. You bring this up a lot, Gary, about MLS eventually. It's when the players are young and let's say they sign for the academy or they sign a homegrown contract, at what point does like the MLS own you to where that it's going to be difficult for you to move overseas? Is it when you sign with the academy or is it a homegrown contract that locks you in and now this franchise owns you, bro? And it's going to be extremely difficult to get out of it.
Yeah. Well, from the moment you set foot in their academy, you're in big trouble already because, and we won't explore it here. Again, there's this thing called training compensation. And if you wanted to leave the MLS Academy and go overseas, then there is a price tag on your head, whether you like it or not. So they're going to have to pay your MLS franchise a certain amount, depending on how long you were in their youth setup and depending where you go. So you might have a price tag on you that ranges anywhere from $60,000 to $500,000. And pretty much zero European clubs are going to go for you unless there's other factors in play.
Yeah. We always
like you're in big trouble. You're in big trouble. And once you sign a homegrown contract or something, you literally are not signing with your franchise. You are not an employee of Houston or Real Salt Lake or Montreal. You're not their employee. You're not their player. You are owned by the league. The league signs your paychecks. You are an employee of the league. And if the league determines, hey, you know what? Yeah, this Houston player, we're going to ship him off to Nashville. You have no say in the matter. Zero. They'll just ship you off to Nashville. Oh, Nashville doesn't want you. Okay, we'll ship you to Orlando or Portland. Zero. Zero say. You work for the league. You do not work. There are no clubs here, Benny. You don't work for the team or the franchise.
Soccer North Korea, bro.
It's bad, man. It's bad. It's bad.
Let me pull up this picture in case nobody saw it.
Nice. That's good. That's good artistry, man.
Legendary, bro. No, we always say, Gary, that we're going to do a whole episode on training compensation and solidarity payment. So maybe I'll sit down with you one of these times that we meet up and you can tell me the best way to extract all this information out of you because I'm curious about it myself, you know?
Yeah. Perfect. And the reason I say it needs to be done right, because it'd be nice if we can show people a case study, like with actual numbers. And then it kind of like hits home more than anything else, instead of it just being like a qualitative sort of verbal chit chat.
Get the Drake equation out, bro.
It's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you explained the Drake equation, because I have a feeling some people in the audience were thinking about the rapper, bro. They're like, what the fuck?
No.
They're like, what does Gary know about Drake?
Hey, what made you want to talk about pro player development today?
The last conversation that we had when we met at the Chop House about, you know, when these players that have so much potential and so much quality and they have the ability to go to the top, but there's all these external factors that just hinder their growth and hinder their development when they do make it pro. You know, it's, to me, it's kind of sad to see like how far players could have gone, you know, especially players that we know, and other outside factors contributed to their demise or their downfall. You know, it happens to everywhere, right?
Yeah. To the vast majority.
Yeah. And my hope is that a parent listening to this or a coach listening to this, and they have these types of players, that they can prep them. Obviously the parent of the, or the coach, can't make all the decisions when the kid becomes a pro, and they, like you always say, they can't kick the soccer ball for them. They can't choose for them to not have that Coke or have a burger up, you know, it's on the player. But I think if a player can recognize it, and they're taught this from an early age of, dude, once you make it, you have to continue to grind every single day. They keep going, bro. Because it's sad how many players could have made it, and just little things that got in their way. I don't know, that conversation we had is just stuck in my head.
Got it. But folks really need to understand that this happens everywhere in the world, and to, I'm throwing a number out there, and to greater than 90% of the players who become pros, greater than 90%, this happens to them. They just fade and die, and then they're done.
Yeah.
Almost 9 out of 10 don't have longevity, man.
Yeah.
The problem is that the public just never hears about it, you know, because you're always seeing the stars, right? And the stars are always the stars, and they're always the starters, and they're in the Champions League team, and they have longevity. And, you know, you don't see all the players who make it and then fade, and by year 3, 4, or 5, it's over. They don't exist anymore. That happens to almost all of them. Think about it. Look at the big teams in Europe, just because everybody's associated with them or is familiar with them. Why every single time you look at the lineup sheet, almost always and for years, it's the same players. Okay, so where are the other players, right? Some are injected once in a while, but then it just fades. It's always like the same starting 11 or starting 15, or it's always the same 15 or 18 players forever. And yeah, some are sold, but the ones that are purchased or brought in, they were the same starters elsewhere. You know, so it's always the same group of animals and beasts, you know, that are playing. And everybody else kind of tries to pop their head above water for a little bit and maybe gets a few opportunities here or there, and then they die and they disappear, and you're playing second division Poland or something like that. And then you're done.
Yeah. No, it happens everywhere. I think a famous example that everybody's aware of is like Dele Alli. And there's a video of him and Mourinho. Mourinho sits him down and says, look, dude, you have the potential to be one of the best in the world, but he literally tells him, your mentality is shit. And then you look at him like 4 or 5 years later, he's not where he could have been, you know, and Mourinho was 100% right.
Role models are very important too, Ben, because some people might think that they're working hard and like you said, grinding every day and all that stuff. Some might think they're doing that, but they're not. Oh, what do you mean? Like I'm there on time. I leave on time. I'm there early. Actually, I go there 1 or 2 hours before. I hit the gym. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm eating right. Not enough. You have to be a psycho, Benny. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches: you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant, possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.